Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. Every week we talk about how insane it can be to simply live in America. But this week, we're going to try to help you do something about it by welcoming journalist and author James Polis to the show. James's new book, The Art of Being Free, looks back at Alexis de Tocqueville's masterwork, Democracy in America, and pulls from its pages some wisdom about how each of us can confront the challenges of love, sex, loss, and this crazy-making, frustrating, wonderful nation that is both our predicament and birthright. Yeah, for a brief mad moment, we're going to try out this optimism thing we've heard so much about. Meanwhile, we've got politics as well. It seems like only 8 years ago, the Affordable Care Act was galvanizing town hall protests all across the country, birthing new political movements. Well, it's happening again. Only this time, all the players are reversed, and President Obama's landmark health care bill's defenders are the ones getting into lawmakers' grills. We'll talk about this phenomenon. We're also going to spend a little time trying to get into the head of House Speaker Paul Ryan to figure out what GOP lawmakers might do next. Finally, after their first attempt at a Muslim travel ban ended in chaos and court decisions, the Trump administration is going back for a second bite of the apple. Plans are afoot to release a new executive order that promises the same policy effects, but with sufficient technical tweaks to avoid judicial rejection. We'll discuss that coming order, the stepped-up enforcement actions from ICE, and the possibility that Trump might be wavering on one of his immigration promises. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Jonathan Cohn, Arthur Delaney, Elise Foley, and Lauren Weber. And here's what happened first. Hello to everyone in the land. Welcome again to another edition of So That Happened, a weekly digest of undigested angst and news about politics. My name is Jason Linkins. I'm the editor of Eat the Press at the Huffington Post. And we have a very good show today, which we'll kick off first by introducing our friends. Zach Carter, he's our friend.
Greetings, friends.
How are you, Zach?
Friendly.
Okay, that's good to know. And a very special treat we have from the Morning Email, Lauren Weber.
Hello, hello.
Former Goldman Sachs, Lauren Weber.
You know, I really don't love how we include this in every podcast.
I know, it's just important to establish these things.
Yeah, well, you know, my time right. In banking, loads
I did,
of fun.
I'm a former government contractor. I'm no angel.
I also am a former government contractor, so I got it all, you know?
We're no angels.
Yeah.
Zach's an angel.
I used to play in punk bands.
Right, so Zach
wins. That was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So we wanted to start today. We've talked a little bit about – well, we talked a lot about, you know, what Democrats have been doing in the brief period of time we've been with a Trump administration. And we've seen a party kind of fumbling their way toward ecstasy and a base that seems pretty riled up and getting organized. And we've now seen – this sort of manifests itself at town halls. We're living through town hall version 2.0. We remember back in 2009 as the effort to pass a healthcare reform bill ramped up. Town halls became jumping off places for people to yell at their elected officials. It was a big way in which the Tea Party first fomented itself. Now we see sort of history repeating itself, right?
It seems that way to me, and I think, you know, in large part, what we're seeing in these protests. Obviously, I haven't been to every single one of these events or polled every single person there, but just the impression that I'm getting from the things that people are saying at some of the more heated town halls. This is not the radical left showing up and voicing their desire to seize the means of production. What you have here are essentially rank-and-file Democrats and then a lot of rank-and-file Republicans who want to see some results, who are worried about Trump or angry about Trump. And it is for the most part, a group of people who are very, very animated who aren't typically people you see out there getting animated about politics.
And to be clear, that's not what the White House believes. You know, Trump tweeted yesterday that he thinks it's a bunch of paid protesters.
Which is itself sort of a funny concept, right? Like there are people who organize public events who try to get people out in public to protest things that are bad. Sometimes they're called community organizers. They can be, housing advocates. They can be all sorts of things. But just because something is actually organized doesn't mean that the anger and the expression that happens at an organized event doesn't count. You know, if somebody drives you to the polling place so you can vote, your vote still matters. You still got to vote your thing. When you show up and tell people that you're angry at a protest, if somebody from Move On told you where to go, that doesn't mean you're not angry.
I'm kind of intrigued by this whole idea that money taints political speech.
It's kind of what concept, Jason?
It's pretty weird. It's pretty weird because I think that there's a bunch of addled billionaires who would disagree with the idea that money taints political speech. I believe there have been a few important Supreme Court rulings that have strenuously advised against discounting money as political speech. And what's funny to me is that I do not see a lot of people getting rich off of protesting at town halls. It actually begs a question, why not pay people to protest? It's kind of crazy. I mean, it's like if you're good at something, you should be paid for your labor. So, I mean, why would it be bad? I mean, I understand that the idea here is that if you give enough people money, suddenly they become insincere about what they're talking about. And I would just like to point to the entire lobbying industry.
Well, this is once again the double-edged sword of authenticity in politics. I mean, this is what bedeviled Hillary Clinton throughout the entire campaign. This is what, becomes an issue every now and again. Are these protesters authentic? What does that mean?
Oh, yeah. And it goes back to I think that anytime the media starts dictating what is and what isn't authentic, we get out over our skis because how the fuck would we know what authenticity is? I think that one of the interesting things about you bringing up Hillary Clinton in the context of authenticity is that every time Hillary Clinton showed her authentic self anywhere, the media was quick to bash her for it. I worry that sometimes people, just ordinary people who show up to extract from powerful people some part of that power could get tagged by the same brush. I wanted to add, because I think you were alluding to something about this here, is obviously we're not at every single one of these events. But is it unfair to suggest that this is basically, the Democratic resistance? Or are we just talking about people who are without power looking to powerful people to extract some of that?
I think it can be both. I think it can be both. I mean, I think – look, there's Tom Cotton's been a senator for several years now. He has not been getting excoriated by thousands of people in his home state on a regular basis.
Neither is Chaffetz.
Right. Neither is Jason Chaffetz, the congressman from Utah. These are guys who are used to, things going pretty well. They're from conservative districts,
Marsha
conservative
Blackburn.
States.
Yeah.
Right. And they're getting an earful. So I think a lot of that – I think there are two things going on. I think one, the conservative movement is not – really sure what it wants to do about the whole Trump thing. There's a whole lot of different types of Republicans who aren't totally sold on Trump. And you also have a lot of people who are ordinary Republican voters who are comfortable now with Obamacare because they use it and they need it. And they are very nervous about what the Republican Party is going to do. If you listen to these testimonials, most of the testimonials that you're hearing are related to the Affordable Care Act and people with
We have to remember that 30% of the American public doesn't know the difference between Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
They think they're different things.
Or, I mean,
just saying.
For a long time, in different states.
They are the same thing in case anyone's confused.
Yeah. And they're branded. Like Kentucky, it's called Connect, right? Kentucky's version of Obamacare is called Connect.
Sure, yeah. California, it's called Covered California. Yeah.
People in Kentucky love Connect. They hate Obamacare. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
But But so there are groups of disgruntled conservatives. But I do think a lot of what's happening here is just sort of the same anger that you saw with the Tea Party in 2009, which is it's just straight up partisanship to some extent. People who are accustomed to being in power didn't feel the need to go out and make a big fuss about things because they thought George W. Bush was going to take care of it for them. Democrats right now, I mean, I've talked to a lot of these protesters. A lot of them are, lawyers and professional class people who have been politically active and in the past at different times, but basically, had some kids during the Obama era. It just didn't seem like things were that like the emergency was that serious. Now, with Trump being president, they're locked in again, and they're going out to airports, they're going out to town halls. It's become a more pressing, urgent issue for them.
You just mentioned how Republicans are still kind of trying to figure out how to navigate a world in which Trump is essentially now the cult of personality atop their party. We hear tell of, some teeth being ground in the dust when Trump goes out and speaks in public. But throughout it all, they do seem pretty steadfast in their initial support for this presidency. The repeal and replace Obamacare part of this is going really sideways on them. Is right now the public expression that's happening? Do you think that's adding to that? Do you think that being in a room full of people that they can perhaps discount as liberals and discount as pro Obama people? Do you think it gets them thinking about, maybe we are in a trap, maybe we should rethink this? Or do you think it steels them against the idea in terms of, like, does it breed negative partisanship?
I think it's hard to say. I mean, if you look at the Never Trumpers, for instance, the people like the National Review, the people like
– no fans of Obamacare there, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, these people were totally fine with saying repeal and replace Obamacare for years. But it seems to me sort of slapdash which conservative figures are embracing Trump and which are staying against him. I mean, the National Review has tilted pretty hard into Trump. They seem to be coming around on the idea that he's their Republican president.
I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is that, we had Tea Party protests against Obamacare during its pre-implementation period. It didn't stop Democrats from implementing Obamacare. Why would we think that a public protest would influence Republicans to change their minds?
I don't necessarily think that this is going to influence Republicans to change their minds. I think the stats about 20 million people losing health care is more problematic than these town hall protests.
I think there's both things going on there. I think people, it's been demonstrated that when you just flood congressional offices with calls, people freak out. They totally did that during the bailout vote in 2008. They did that during the government shutdown, and Republicans totally backed off of their government shutdown thing in 2013. I think the direct contact does have some sort of visceral human, animal spirits thing that goes off inside people. And they're like, oh, there may not be enough people here who are calling in to matter in my district, but geez, they're really angry at me. I better do something. Paul Ryan doesn't care about any of this stuff. He's an ideologue who wants to cut taxes for rich people and take away health insurance from poor people. That's just part of his plan. He doesn't believe in government medicine, even if it's this weird market hybrid that Obamacare represents. So he wants to push through that agenda. Politics be damned. The other politicians, they're people who just want to get elected. I mean, taking away health insurance from 20 million people sounds like a great way to make sure that 20 million people don't vote for you. And
exactly.
Most of those people are not Democrats. Most of those people live in red states and rural areas where they don't have a lot of money.
And there's also some dissonance in between Congress and Trump on this. I mean, Trump has gone out and said, maybe we'll have something at the end of 2017, beginning of 2018. Then you have Ted Cruz being like, we're going to have something next month. It's a bit unclear.
That's been an act they've been at for years, though.
Still, the misinformation, I think, leads to people showing up to these town halls because they just have no idea, as does most of the public, what actually is up and down.
Yeah, good point.
We're also forgetting that Obamacare, it's now popular because Obama's not in power anymore. And so people are pushing back against Trump and the Republicans for taking it away.
Yeah.
But there have been real problems with Obamacare.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect system at all.
And what's – I think one thing that's kind of disappointing about this is that the opportunities to fix it I mean, the Republicans were never serious about that, but there is just going to be no way to deal with the existing problems in the system because it's going to be keep or kill for the entire presidency.
Okay. That's a nice little catchphrase there, keep or kill.
I actually think that people should be in their congressperson's face on the regular basis. I just wanted to introduce a bit of skepticism and challenge the premise a little bit. One of the interesting things that we've seen, of course, and this is, I guess, another redux of 2009, is that we're seeing Congress critters not able to face the music.
Yes. We're seeing people having phone town halls instead.
Yeah. A notable exception to this is Michigan Representative Justin Amash, who seems to actually want to face his constituents.
Did you call him Amash?
Amash, sorry. I
wasn't quite sure on that one.
I really apologize for that. I don't know why I said that. Amash, who seems to really relish having these conversations with his constituents, even when they get heated,
good for him.
He stands and he faces it. And he was talking about after his last town hall event where he got into some arguments and people didn't always agree with him. He was talking afterwards. He's like, we've got to go longer. We got to have a bigger venue, invite more people. It's a markedly different attitude from what we've seen in a lot of these cases where, like you mentioned, people will do it over the telephone or they won't have town halls.
The number of town halls has dropped off dramatically in the past month.
I mean, are we seeing who's really got the profile and courage up on Capitol Hill? I don't usually extend that.
Well,
idea.
Also, when is he up for re-election?
Every 2 years.
Yeah, every 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
Well, then good for him. I mean, that's
he likes combat, though. I mean, he's unpopular on Capitol Hill among Republicans because he will just take it to them. He's a pretty hardline libertarian, doesn't believe in a lot of things that the Republican Party has voted for and supported over the last 20 years. And he doesn't care. He doesn't care that it's, that the party wants to do this. He says, no, this is bad and I'm going to vote for it. I think, his political philosophy is a little convoluted, but you can't say the guy is not principled. This is going to be a really weird couple of years here. I mean, most politicians are total cowards. They care about getting elected more than they care about anything else. And there are a few who care about doing the right thing more than they care about getting elected, but not many. It's just not a very having a spine is not common on Capitol Hill.
Well, and I mean, you saw that even today yesterday with the rescinding of the transgender rule that Betsy DeVoy,
DeVos.
DeVos. I can never remember. Is it French? I don't know. DeVos. You read that New York Times piece where she basically had the option to resign or sign the bill saying, that's fine, we'll take away transgender protections and sign the bill.
Yeah. She's
the order. Sorry.
Basically, the Sessions Bannon wing of the White House told her, it's your job or sign this thing.
I was stunned to be confronted with the idea that Betsy DeVos believed in something. That was like, whoa, what happened? World turned tilted on its axis a little bit.
Yeah, and it was something that involved just being nice to people who are different from you too, which didn't seem to be like something that was really on display in her confirmation hearing. But
there was.
It's okay. She's a moral coward, so never mind.
Don't worry. At any rate, I think this is going to become a thing. It's going to be it's February. The town halls in 2009 didn't really get ramped up to the summer recesses.
Well, Jason, it's a new era we're in now.
It's lit, man.
It's just everything's on fire.
I don't know if you guys noticed this, but Donald Trump is president.
everything is burning.
Thanks for the reminder. All right. Lauren, thanks for being with
us. Thanks for having
me. Zach, thanks you for being with us. We have a really, really fun show today. James Polis is here to talk about his book, The Art of Being Free. You will hear this interview and you will wonder why so many campus conservatives decided to make Milo Yiannopoulos famous instead of James. Give your money to James. He's great. We have a good show. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We'll be right back. And welcome back. We're here with Zach Carter.
Hi, everybody.
And on the phone with us, a really good friend of ours. You have read his work at The Week and at The Federalist, but I'm pretty sure the most important job of his life was being a producer, presenter, devil on our shoulder at HuffPost Live, which has just recently been made popular by Saturday Night Live. Please welcome our friend James Polis.
Hello, gentlemen.
How are you doing, sir? It's been a while. This is like a reunion here.
This is. It's a season for reunions, for reaching back out to those who you care about in these perilous, turbulent times.
These are perilous and turbulent times. And one of the great things about having you on the show right now is that you have written a book about how to sort of face these perilous and turbulent and crazy-making times by going back to Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote Democracy in America so many, 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 many years ago. You have taken this kind of like very kind of sideways approach to him. It's a little bit of history, philosophy, a little bit of like hanging on to the electrodes with both hands and cheering about it. Tell us, why did you write this book? What gave you this inspirado?
Well, you know, I knew that American life was crazy, and I knew from Tocqueville that it always has been, in a way. I was halfway through writing the book, and this guy named Donald Trump started to have some success in the Republican primary season. So
heard of that guy.
I lost a month of book writing time just trying to sort of figure out how to digest the dawning Trumpocracy into the book, and I'll leave that to the reader to discover. It worked out to my satisfaction, but the long and short of it is, I knew from Tocqueville that his warnings, but also his encouragements about the inherently crazy character of American life, were going to be more important than ever. Not just to the conservatives and the libertarians, you know, my dear friends who are like primed to love Tocqueville all over again, but for everyone else too. Tocqueville, the real Tocqueville in there in Democracy in America, is not a political scientist. He's not someone who you can trot out to sort of justify your budget plan or whatever. He was a guy who traveled young and wrote Democracy in America young, and he was a melancholy genius who died young, and he lived a life of experience and vulnerability in a way that I think we can all recognize when we read the book and when we read my book. I realized that I needed to present that part of myself in the same way in order to make it clear that this is a book for anyone who finds themselves topsy-turvy in these times and wants to recognize the good in being human, warts and all. So
you mentioned there, I mean, Tocqueville is you know, kind of beloved in sort of conservative or center right circles. And then people to the left sort of, you know, fuss about him in different ways. I include myself in that community of people who are fussy about Tocqueville. But what drew you to him? What are the ideas there that you think explain something useful for people today?
Tocqueville, there's so many ways to answer the question, but I think the most important one is probably that in spite of the fact that Tocqueville was very worried about how things could go wrong for America, he still thought that our saving grace was that we were able to learn from our mistakes and adapt to them. And it gave us a kind of fortitude or resilience that he found lacking elsewhere in the world.
This is the thing. So I think that's in there, and I agree. And the thing that's always bugged me about Tocqueville is that I feel like we often don't. Like it's what, 40 years after the book's written, we have a civil war, we now have Trump. Like, how do you find that sort of ideal version of you know, an America that I think even lefties could say is like a good way to be? Like, how do you get there from a time of darkness like we're living in right now?
Well, I think you look at what persists. You know, it is frustrating that right now the people who are getting the most attention are those who seem most dedicated to pursuing attention for its own sake. You know, I, as a matter of sort of personal rectitude and basic respect for people, I try not to dedicate my life to weaponizing my identity and accumulating as many haters as I can and turning those haters into money. I think there's something I think there's something fundamentally rotten morally with a society that views freedom as how many haters you can afford. That is bothersome for sure.
You talking about anybody in particular there? I can think of a few.
I think we can all think of more than a few.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, if you look at what has persisted throughout American history, despite times that frankly were a hell of a lot worse than these, more confusing,
that's true,
more sort of bloodier, more unjust. What persisted, friendship, not the BFF kind, not the fake Facebook friend kind, but genuine face-to-face friendship and shared love and the ability to pull yourself out of yourself and into that risky, vulnerable space where freedom, I think, can be found and where the patterns that defeat us can at least for a little while be broken.
There's something very nice about reading your book alongside, so many conversations I've been having with my dad lately about politics. And one of the things that he's stressed with me is to like disabuse yourself of the notion that right now you're living through a unique period in American history. One of the things I loved about what your book did is it animated Tocqueville in a way that it kind of felt like this predicament that America is in is also sort of its birthright. And you take us through really important archetypes of living: death, love, sex. When you wrote this book, tell me how did you imagine readers would interact with it?
Well, I hope that they would see themselves in it. My road has been a strange one through law school and grad school and writing a novel and having the novel ruined by 9/11 and being engaged and unengaged and married and divorced, and it's been a weird road. But the commonalities in the way that humans blunder through this world. I mean, Tocqueville said that the short space of 60 years can't capture the longings of our hearts, no matter how much money we have or how many, people sort of retweet our tweets or how alone we feel or not. That experience of restlessness and melancholy and yearning that goes beyond what we know is the scope of our lives, these things are baked in. And I figured out that the only way I could immerse people in the material that Tocqueville was presenting and also do it in a way that reflected the strangeness and the pain, but also the promise of joy in our times was to bare my own soul. Tocqueville said that the Americans really only want to read about themselves. The kind of polytheistic gods of the old days, or nature and hippie togetherness. Those are kind of fleetingly interesting topics, but they don't really grab us, and they don't show us what it is that we think that we need to hear in order to feel like we're not just sort of the most insignificant, interchangeable specks in the world.
Well, I mean, given that we are the most insignificant, interchangeable specks in the world, that is a tough sell. But I want to ask you this because Tocqueville is something that everybody reads, when they're in high school or college on some level. And there's this sort of generalized understanding of this guy as an important thinker. Was there anything that jumped out at you while you're doing the research for this book that made you think, hey, that my understanding of this guy was wrong? There's something different about this guy that I need to know, that the rest of the world needs to know.
Tocqueville was a sort of sad ex-Catholic, but he still thought with Catholic categories of thought. His patterns of thinking were richly informed by the likes of guys like Blaise Pascal. And so the conservative Tocqueville, quote unquote, is a guy who's very much about traditional morality and how, you need to have like good religious sturdy folk in order for civic society to work and all that. And the more that I dug into what Tocqueville really had to say about religion, the more complicated it got in some ways, but the simpler in others. He said that the genius of Christianity was that it only gave people a couple very general precepts: love God and love your neighbor. That even something as simple and basic as those two precepts of faith enabled people to orient themselves in a world where, if you lacked that kind of anchor, nothing would make sense to you and you would feel swept away by everything. But if you did have that anchor, then you could range freely across the whole field of human endeavor and science and art and technology and history, culture. Tocqueville feared that religions that purported to dig too deep into the details of everyday life would cut against the grain of life in a democratic age, and that it would drive people even crazier than we Americans are. So there's more than meets the eye to Tocqueville on religion, and I think he holds out a promise of reconciling ourselves to our crazy world, even with forms of religion that are not as traditional as the traditionalists might think. That struck me as very important.
I think that's a really great point, because I think it, for a lot of people in on the sort of secular left over the last 20 or 30 years, they've become frightened of religion in this way, because I think to some extent they think that it means this very detailed sort of set of life guides that includes a bunch of stuff that they don't necessarily agree with. But it has made it very difficult for people who have very deeply felt moral convictions to communicate those convictions to other people, because they've lost this ability to understand religion as a more sort of basic fundamental set of ideas rather than a guide to every single decision you make in your life. I think it's been very problematic for the Democratic Party, certainly, but I think it's also been destructive to the way we just get along with each other in civil society.
I think that's right. And for my friends on the left, if you guys want to, if you want to take a bat to the sort of new alt-right folks that you're most afraid of, you have to find a way to reconnect with that deeper spiritual reality that so many human beings live in. It's hard because many people today either inherit some sort of religious code and haven't really lived hard enough to come to it on their own. And so much of life needs to be rooted in experience in order for it to actually to keep a grip on us amid everything that's so much in flux. Ralph Waldo Emerson, who is more or less a contemporary of Tocqueville, said experience is the hands and feet of every enterprise, and that goes for religion too. So, it's a hard counsel to say to people, you just need to go get your ass kicked more. Come back to me when you've hurt, when you've been broke, when you've had your heart broken, then we can talk.
Especially in this particular moment, but
it's really hard for readers out there for me to describe James's book to people, because it's not like it has a plot arc. It's not like it even so much begins with the thesis and kind of expounds on it. It's more of like kind of a ruminative journey. And, we're talking about kind of what gets lost when you sort of step away from a religion. One of the big things that gets lost is just like taking the time to reflect and ruminate about things that are bigger than you. What I would say is I'd recommend James's book to anyone who wants to like take up that task. If you're not ready to maybe delve into reading St. Augustine every season, this is a really good book to start. I don't know if you intended it to be read like that, but I could see people coming back to this book time and time again if they're feeling bad, if there's something, if they're facing loss. You have stuff to say about like all facets, all seasons of life. And I think also people would be very cheered and encouraged by the journey you take in this book. Does that sort of describe maybe what you're looking for? Not like a disposable read, but something people keep coming back to.
That is exactly what I hope to achieve. And I'm honestly quite touched that happened for you, and that you think it could happen to others. I've told a couple of my friends I wanted to write a book that would last at least as long as a building, and given how many just terribly fucking ugly buildings there are in the world, that seemed like not a super arrogant thing to say. But I wanted it to sort of be a building too. I wanted it to be a refuge where you could come and be quiet and have, a space that was safe, not for its own sake, but that you could then leave that space and go back into the world prepared to take on risks that are worthy of our human life force, which is just, which is in danger of being squandered and pissed away every minute of every day. We can't live the lives of superheroes, but we don't need to. It's good to be human. It's good enough to be human. And amid the insanity of life, when so much of political argument seems to be either people acting like prosecuting attorneys or just resorting to mockery as a form of argumentation, it's so difficult to find the opportunity to rest with something and to live with something and to speak to yourself and to your friends and with people who are long dead as if they were intimates and the things that occur in the space where you have intimate conversation, where people are able to bear themselves to each other, not for the sake of just having, you know, sex and then never speaking to them again, but in a more important way than that. I think that's going to save us in a way that politics isn't going to save us. Our problems aren't illnesses to be cured or equations to be solved. They're things that we have to live with and learn to live with well.
Well, James, I'm really glad we got to you before Krista Tippett and On Being at NPR. This has been really awesome. The book is super thoughtful and really, really interesting.
It's a super fun book to read,
and,
too.
And also, yeah, also just actually fun to read. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you.
All right,
that was James Polis. His book is called The Art of Being Free. You should get it. It's really quite fun and good. Hello, welcome back, and we're here now to talk about one of our one of the most important people in Washington D.C., Beltway Egghead, Paul Ryan, Wisconsin Representative, Speaker of the House, widow's peak that you can cut brie with, Paul Ryan, and joining us to talk about this, we got Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
Right here. And fellow P90X enthusiast Jonathan Cohn.
I am here.
Yes. Now, Jonathan, you have written a piece for us in which you've perfectly distilled Paul Ryan. You've put Paul Ryan into your bloggy autoclave and have created and discovered the essence of Paul Ryan. The nucleus at the center of all things Paul Ryan. Congratulations. Let's give him a round of applause for that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Clap. You were the Hadron Particle Accelerator of Paul Ryan. So tell us, what did you discover about Paul Ryan?
Well, I think in fairness, we need to share credit with the speaker, right? Because this was the article I wrote was all about a tweet that he wrote.
So we're willing to share credit.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, he distilled his own essence. I just observed and interpreted it. But he had, he was tweeting about the Affordable Care Act, which, as you know, is one of his favorite subjects. And he made the point that we need to repeal the law because the law had crushed freedom. And taking the law away, repealing it, and replacing it with whatever the Republicans cook up.
Freedom, I guess.
Increase freedom. It's freedom, like in the Mel Gibson, Braveheart. Freedom! So that's what it's all about.
Okay.
Well, he said freedom, the essence of freedom is being able to buy whatever health insurance you want and not to have Washington tell you.
That's right.
Okay. But the Affordable Care Act created a marketplace where people could buy the insurance they wanted.
Right.
So I'm skeptical about how people have been enslaved by this.
Right. So if you look at the world the way Paul Ryan does, and Rand, people in that part of the universe, they say, aha, Obamacare, it applied all these rules to insurance. And when government applies rules, that crushes freedom. So first of all, let's say that, freedom's a good thing. We all are in favor of freedom. And number two,
yes,
it is absolutely true that the Affordable Care Act put a lot of new rules on health insurance, right? So, nowadays, insurers used to be free to deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. They can't do that anymore. Insurers used to be able to sell policies that were had huge gaps, right? They didn't cover mental health, or they didn't cover a lot of rehabilitative services or maternity. And now they can't do that anymore. And they used to be able to charge a lot more to people who were older or sicker, and now they really can't, or they're limited in what they can do. And it used to be if you didn't want to buy health insurance, and you could, you had a policy available, that was fine. That was your choice. Now it's still your choice, but the government will make you pay a penalty, right? That's the individual mandate. So these are new rules. The government has applied rules. But I think when most people think about freedom is also the freedom to get a health insurance policy when you need it. It's the freedom to be able to get health care, to get it without going bankrupt. And of course, you know, as you were saying, I mean, you think about it, in the old days, right? I mean, yes, everybody was free to get a health insurance policy, whatever they wanted. But right. if you were poor, you know, if you and or even if you were middle class and you were trying to buy a policy on your own, you probably couldn't afford a comprehensive one. It was too expensive. And if you had a pre-existing condition, well, good luck to you, because in most states, you know, the insurance company could say no. And so you really were not free to get a health insurance policy.
I guess in those circumstances, you were free to pay out the nose for emergency care at hospitals and whatnot.
Absolutely. You were free to go bankrupt from your medical bills. You were free not to get the health care that your doctor prescribed.
Free to die from things that are get easily treated.
Yes.
So in other words, Paul Ryan revealed through this message on Twitter that he ignores a type of economic freedom that's necessary, and that without money, there's a lot of things you don't have the freedom to do.
That's right. That's right. You know, with healthcare, I mean, again, this is to play a twist on saying Bernie Sanders said a couple of weeks ago in that debate with Ted Cruz. I mean, you know, I'm free to buy a yacht, right?
Right.
You know, I can retire at the age of 50 if I want.
I'm free to eat all my meals at French Laundry if you I know, prefer.
Absolutely. I don't have the money to do it. It's not something I can actually
eat. You're free to eat cake.
That's right. Now, with healthcare, there is the added complication that because of this issue with the pre-existing conditions, because of the way health insurance works, even if you have the money, sometimes you can't get the coverage you need. And in fact, this is a classic case. I mean, if we want to not to get too, you know, in the weeds here about economics, but this is a classic case of a market that does not work without regulation. It really doesn't. And, you know, we see that in other markets. You know, in the same way, sometimes you need to regulate them, or you need to put in rules so there can actually be decent competition. I mean, one of the funny things is, and I didn't actually write about this, but this is an important point, is that in the old days, there wasn't a lot of real competition for people buying health insurance. You know, people didn't understand the policies they were buying. Insurers could pick and choose who to cover. You know, nowadays, particularly where the program is working well, if you go to a state like California, you have a market now where there's, you know, there's some rules about basic guidelines of what all the policies have to look like. And so people can really kind of – they can really shop for the first time. They can say, oh, you know, I like this policy because it gives me certain services that I value. This one here seems to be cheaper and it doesn't seem to offer less, so maybe it's more efficient. You actually have real competition, which is, you know, what a lot of conservatives say they want. But if it weren't for the rules of Obamacare, you wouldn't have those competition. You wouldn't have that shopping.
So we're going to get rid of Obamacare, right? Or are we?
So I'm going to – my standard disclaimer here, which is number one, I don't do predictions.
Come on.
Number two, I was around in 2009 and 2010. I covered that Affordable Care Act was declared dead so many times.
We actually have a regulation against that disclaimer, so just right. stop
so,
it.
So,
just
okay.
make some predictions.
So right. I will say that the odds have shifted dramatically since the election. You know, whereas I think after the election, it sort of looked like the odds on they were going to repeal it and replace it. It looks less and less likely. We just had John Boehner. I don't know if you saw this.
Yeah, John Boehner this week. What did he say?
He said, this isn't going to happen. He said, they're going to come up with something that looks a lot like the Affordable Care Act because it's just too hard to dislodge. And it is. I mean, look, they have a very thin margin in the Senate. You know, and we have at least a dozen Republican senators now expressing serious reservations about components of this.
You got governors who don't want to give up the money.
You have governors who don't want to. And the big problem is, you know, the rhetoric that the Republicans have had all time, they have just bashed and bashed the Affordable Care Act for in many cases for things that it doesn't, you know, the deductibles are too high, you know, there aren't enough plan choices, it's too expensive. Well, a lot of that's real. Some of it's not real. But their plans do not make these problems better. I mean, basically, they deregulate, they take money out of the system, and you end up with either more people without health coverage or the people who have health coverage have even higher out-of-pocket costs.
Yeah.
This is not what people want.
It's funny. We're still really circling around what David Frum pointed out was the original sin of hostility towards this, was that Republicans should have gotten skin in the game and worked with Democrats to come up with something that was palatable, that they could all take credit for.
Yeah.
That actually had some of their vision as part of it. Instead, they abandoned the task, except for, you know, now deceased Senator Bennett, and became purely sort of like a lycanthropic opposition to this bill. And now they have to unwind it because of the promises they made to the constituents. They're finding it deeply, deeply difficult to do so.
They're not gonna. just like I said after the election, they're not gonna, because they're chicken. They're afraid to follow through on their promise of freedom because doing so would take away insurance for 20 million people who would then be mad.
I don't know if you guys have ever talked to Canadians about their health. I'm seeing a lot of nods. So we've talked to Canadians about their health care.
I don't know what that is.
The Canadian health care system is a government-run single-payer system. It has a lot more rules governing it. And I remember being in Toronto. When you're an American traveling in Canada, Canadians want to talk about politics all the time. They mostly want to talk about guns and health care. And I was at the St. Lawrence Market talking to a guy working at a food kiosk selling mustard. And he was talking about how, you know, his healthcare system allowed he got some kind of like this degenerative disease, like one of those flesh eating bacteria situations. Hospitalized him, laid him up at home. He said that, you know, all that stuff, his costs were covered. He actually got home healthcare visits from registered nurses to help him convalesce and recover. He's back at work, happier than ever.
Selling mustard,
you know, it was and striking up fun conversations with people on the market. And he asked me, what is the argument against that? And I said, if Paul Ryan was here talking to you about what you endured, he'd say, so you're alive, you're back at work, you're healthy again, you're happy again, but you're not free.
Hot dog.
And the guy just had no response to that. He thought it was just the craziest argument he'd ever heard. He was like, my livelihood, I'm back at work. Yeah. I'm doing what I want. How is this not freedom? I don't get it.
Because the government made you.
Right. The government made you get well.
Yeah,
I can tell you, I've actually spent a lot of time researching systems abroad. So I've talked to people in France, I've talked to people in the Netherlands, in England. I've spoken, you know, on the phone stuff with people from Sweden, right? You know, socialist Sweden, right?
Pray for Sweden.
And
pray for Sweden.
Right, right. Shouldn't bring up Sweden.
They've endured so much.
I hate to use them as a political prop at this difficult time, but. And they all say the same thing. And they look – I would have these conversations. They'd ask me what healthcare in the United States was like. And I'd explain, well, it depends on what kind of insurance you have, if you have insurance. I mean, this was pre-Obamacare, but even now, you know, whatever. And they would just give you this look like, people tolerate that? I mean, they could not understand how we could live with that kind of system that was so arbitrary and so, you know, and left so many people out. And what you're describing about the freedom there, I think – that, you know, this is a conception of freedom. It's Roosevelt's, right? It's the four freedoms, right? I mean, this, right. You know, freedom from want, freedom from fear. And, you know, and that's the conflict. I mean, if you're Paul Ryan, by definition, if the government is improving, you know, imposing rules, then you've lost freedom. And I think a lot of us think, well, let's look at the sum total, you know, and if somebody's able to work, you know, if they don't have to walk around in pain, they're not going to – that's freedom too.
I mean, we don't really have the freedom to die because the hospital will just stitch you up anyway.
They will, although they'll come after you.
They're not even going to get rid of that. It's just a crappier way of socializing the costs.
I feel – and this is something we talked about with Jeff Young on a number of occasions. But I feel like what's really being articulated by Paul Ryan is that – if you led a good and moral life, you'll be able to afford insurance. And then if you can't afford insurance, it's because of the choices you've made, and now you must live with the consequences.
I think
that's the nutshell.
I mean, look, I hate to get into people's brains. I think if you go on the right, you know, overall, I think you see that thread. There are definitely people who buy into that, and I think that's what they think. I mean, I think you're right. I think there's a sense of virtue here. If you have health insurance, you know, you must be virtuous, and if you can't pay your bills, you must not. The problem is – if you actually go out in the world, you find all kinds of people who, through no fault of their own, are in trouble with healthcare. And you know what? A lot of them voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
A lot of them are Republicans. And this is, you know, to get back to your question of whether this will happen or not, the problem with Republicans, one of the big problems is it's not, you know, this isn't just a matter of passing a law that's likely to harm Democrats. There's a lot of Republicans who depend on that law for their health insurance, and it's going to go away if the Republicans repeal it, whether or not they replace it. And so that's a big problem.
Right. All right. Well, thank you. This has been an excellent conversation. I'm sure we're going to have many more as we watch the GOP attempt to do something about health care. I still kind of think maybe there's going to be one or two marginal tweaks. They call it Trump care. They get to take credit for it because I still to this day believe that most of what drives people on Congress to do the things they do is just whether they get to take credit for something because they're all shallow as shit. Anyway, Jonathan, thanks for being with us. Arthur, thanks for being with us. Pray for Sweden if you're on your own when all the pretty birds have flown. Honey, I'm still free. Take a chance on me. Love you, Sweden. We'll be right back. Hello, So That Happened listeners. I want to just take a moment to ask you to do a few small favors. First, if you like the show and want to help more people find it, go over to iTunes and just leave us a review. Every review we get bumps the show a little bit higher in the podcast charts. It does make a difference, and it's going to help us build this community. Second, are there issues you'd like us to address? People you think we should talk to? You should drop us an email at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. We really do appreciate your suggestions, and we often follow up on stories, and we just like hearing feedback and criticism. So we'd love to hear from you specifically, because you're the people that matter the most to us. Now, back to the show. And we're back, and there are so many things happening in the world of immigration and the Trump administration. And when we have these frustrations, we turn to our pal, Elise Foley, to explain them to us. Elise, welcome.
Thank you.
And Arthur's here, too.
Happy to be here.
Yes.
Explanation. I'm happy to both. I'm sorry that I established that as a thing. Sorry, I was just off the top of my head. I didn't mean to start rhyming. Anyway.
Immigration explanation.
Yeah, exactly. An immigration explanation.
Who is welcome in our nation?
Yeah, exactly. We have a lot of fascination. Okay, stop. Stop. Elise, obviously, when we last had you on, we were talking about an executive order that the Trump administration issued that went sideways and backwards really quick. We've now heard that they have tweaked the order. I don't really understand how they've tweaked the order, because they also say the order would be fundamentally the same. Can you explain what it was that White House aide and nightmare Tinder date Stephen Miller was talking about?
So, right now we still haven't seen the new executive order, so I don't know exactly what will be in it. But basically, he was saying that it'll still have the same ultimate goal slash same ultimate result of, you know, keeping Americans safe and keeping out terrorists. So what that actually will entail is kind of to be determined. But he made it sound like it'll just be these minor tweaks and
technical
fundamentally
in nature.
Yeah, it'll still be, you know, about keeping people out of the country.
Well, first of all, the order they initially released that was sloppily written got stopped by courts.
Yes.
Partly because it wrongly caused all this trouble for people with legitimate visas.
Right, yeah.
And so green card holders.
So it
legal
so they were, they initially were, applies to people with legal – or with people with green cards, and then that was something that was a problem in the courts. So in theory, you know, it could just be the exact same executive order and be like, also – if this does not apply to lawful permanent residents. That could be one way to do it differently.
But for people who don't like constitutional crises, it initially sounded like good news that they, okay, we're just going to do a new order. We're going to obey the court and tailor the new order to what the court said is okay. It's like, okay, you know, that's
you
really
have to
reasonable.
Decide your like level of concern for constitutional crises versus refugees.
Yeah, it went down a notch.
Yeah.
So I feel we're still kind of talking past this, because the ACLU received this news from Miller, and they still have indicated they're kind of jonesing for a fight in court over this. Isn't the Trump administration simply trying to just ban the same people that they deem to be mud people from coming to the United States, and they're just trying to find a technical way around courts that explicitly say you can't have a religious test on immigration or entry into the country?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same. Like I said, we haven't seen it, but it's sounds like it will be the same basic gist, except maybe taking out a few of the provisions that got them in trouble. But yeah, I mean, if your objection to this is based on or the court's objections are based on things like the religious aspect. I don't think that it's all of a sudden not going to involve countries that are Muslim majority. I don't imagine that it's all of a sudden going to be more welcoming of refugees or anything like that. I mean, it's going to have a lot of the same things that people objected to in the first place, and then maybe take out some of the other things that were objected to. I think without a doubt, ACLU basically already said it, but this is going to have a bunch of court challenges as well. This is not going to fix everything and make their legal problems go away.
I kind of feel like the whole keeping people with green cards from coming back into the country was a feature, not a bug of the original order. But moving from that, this has also been a week in which Immigration and Customs Enforcement have ramped up their activity all across the country. And it's caused a lot of consternation among the immigrant community and the people who support the immigrant community. But what we're seeing, is this actually somewhat abnormal? The Obama administration, now I'm going to use the Obama administration correctly, rightly got dinged by the immigrant community and their affiliated allies for setting new standards of deportations. So ICE is out there deporting people. What's changed about the activity now versus the activity we've been living with for the past 8 years?
Well, so the main thing is just what the priorities are for ICE. So ICE, you know, none of the people ICE is picking up now are people who were, you know, completely safe from deportation before. If you're in the country and you don't have authorization under Obama, you could be deported. Under Trump, you could be deported. You know, under Obama, plenty of people who, you know, might have been in situations that a lot of people would consider very sympathetic were still deported. But there were these guidelines, especially in the final 2 years of his administration, that said that there were certain people who were priorities and there were certain people who weren't. And if you encounter somebody who is considered low priority, you just let them go and you let them go about their lives. That's something that made a lot of ICE officers very angry, because they felt that they should be the ones that would get to decide that, not, you know, people from on high saying you can't, you know, hold this person that you think that you should hold. And Trump said that he was going to take the handcuffs off of ICE and in Border Patrol. And basically what happened in this executive order and this memo is that they did. They said that actually here are the priorities. And if you kind of read through it, you might think, okay, so these are the same priorities. They want to prioritize criminals, but they want to define criminals very, very broadly, and define the priority as somebody who, you know, any undocumented person could be a priority. They also want to speed up the deportations, get more people in these expedited proceedings where they don't, you know, maybe even need to be in court, so they get hardly any chance at all to argue their case. Some people maybe would say that they shouldn't be deported because they're fearful of returning to their country, things like that, that, you know, it's harder to do with when you're not physically there. It's impossible to do when you're not there. It's harder to do without an attorney. So there are definitely changes. The law's the same, but there's changes in the way that it's being instructed to be implemented.
So people might be seeing news stories now where it shows an ICE raid at like a restaurant and people are being rounded up and arrested, but that doesn't necessarily reflect a sea change in enforcement. Like, that stuff was still going on.
Yeah, not huge raids quite so much. And I don't know that there have been raids so much like that even now, in terms of like going to a restaurant and asking everybody for their ID. I think it's important to, you know, be a little bit careful with a lot of those things, because there have been a lot of rumors and people being very scared, and, you know, maybe in some cases not in a way that's necessary. But they did in these recent deportation raids kind of go door to door in some cases reportedly, and they picked up people who they were not intending to pick up. That's something that happened in the past, but immigration rights advocates say that, and lawyers say that, it did not happen in the past to the same frequency, at least under Obama, at least in the final years. So, yeah, I mean, I think that we're going to see changes, but also people should know that, I mean, it's not – deportations have never stopped. There's never been like a complete safety from deportations for anybody. So, you know, ICE is doing ICE's job.
I think people do actually need to know that, because it's, yeah, now that it's a symbol of things changing, people might not have realized what it was like in the first place, especially when there's mass protests that are partly addressing this exact issue.
There's been some tension on Capitol Hill over this issue too. Can you explain what happened when Latino lawmakers attempted to meet with people from Immigration and Customs Enforcement about this? Because this story bewilders me. It seems so unnecessary to exclude them.
Yeah,
from these conversations.
It's very.
It's just like an own
it's
goal.
Very strange. So a lot of them requested that they have a meeting with the director of ICE. And along with the Latino lawmakers, some people who were from districts that were heavily affected in these recent raids. And they were told that they could have a meeting. The meeting was scheduled. It was supposed to be last week. Then on the same day as the meeting, they were told that the meeting was canceled and, you know, that they had to cancel it. It's all very like complicated, he said, she said, but basically that they had to cancel it because it was getting bigger and it would have to be bipartisan and he would come to the Hill and have a meeting with people later in the week. They had the meeting later in the week and they didn't invite a lot of the same people who were supposed to go to the first one. And so it was kind of a lot of anger because they requested a meeting, were blown off, then were not invited to the, you know, what was sort of seen to be a replacement meeting.
Yeah, some were kicked out.
Yeah, some of them showed up anyway, tried to go in or did go in and got kicked out.
Who was the meeting with?
The meeting was with members of Congress. It was Republicans and Democrats. So you had people like Bob Goodlatte, who's the head of the Judiciary Committee. He's a Republican. You're putting me on the spot to name names.
The head of ICE, Kelly, was he there?
He was not there. Okay. No, it was the head of ICE. And I said later that they would be happy to meet with any members of Congress that, you know, that want to meet with him. You know, maybe they'll have a meeting in the future, but it was very strange. I could not give an exact answer for why that happened.
Well, it seemed kind of intemperate and unnecessary. One last thing I wanted to ask, or do you have a question? All right, so one last thing I wanted to ask you about is DACA.
Yeah.
So a few days ago at his mostly zany press conference, Donald Trump was asked what would be the fate of the people who currently are in the country under the auspices of DACA. And I remember watching that part and feeling that sort of like hard facade that Trump has always sort of given toward the immigrant community kind of cracked a little bit. Talked about, you know, that it was a lot of kids wrapped up in it and the kids were great and that it was rough. He uses the word rough a lot. And I got the sense that maybe it was something that he didn't really in his heart want to do. And we've seen some delays from the administration on resolving that or modifying the existing policy about DACA. Have you heard anything about what might go forth from what we might see in the next few weeks? Have you heard anything about that?
I'm really not sure. I mean, at the moment, they're sticking with it and they're still even taking applications for it. I think I don't know what he feels in his heart of hearts. I think politically there is a case to be made for not getting rid of a program that protects people from deportation. Dreamers, the young undocumented people, have like done a pretty incredible job over the past decade or so at making themselves be considered by most Americans to be very sympathetic. Obviously, Trump echoes a lot of that language that they have kind of put forward for themselves in a way that's smart. I'm not saying that none of it is true or that all of it isn't true about, you know, through no fault of their own, et cetera. I don't know. I think that there are probably Republicans who would like for him to just keep it so that they don't get the flack for getting rid of it. At the same time, there are a lot of Republicans who are pointing out that he made this promise constantly that he was going to get rid of it. He talked about it all the time that he was going to get rid of it. So
I don't think he ever came face to face with the faces of the people. I don't think he really put like you know, he'd, flesh and blood on the people.
He'd met some of them in person. I mean, yeah, I think that.
When he's talking about getting rid of it, I think since then he's softened a lot.
Sort of, but he's given, yeah, rhetorically he's given different answers. I think I don't know whether, you know, he cares about them specifically or not. At the same time, I think you could theoretically not deport them and also end DACA. He hasn't done that. And so we'll see if he does. But it's interesting that he hasn't yet. It's been, you know, it's been a month. He said he'd do it on day one.
Yeah.
Hasn't done it yet.
That's true. Interesting. I have this feeling that maybe Donald Trump has this kind of like weird soft spot for kids, and that is
giving him so much credit.
If I didn't sincerely think that might be the case, I wouldn't say it. You know, I don't like most of these immigration policies, but you know, if I could keep DACA around, I would. That would just be my personal choice. And if it's politically difficult to do it, then great. Politically difficult. It should be politically difficult to do terrible things. Anyway, Elise, thanks for joining us once again. I'm feeling we'll have you back on
probably
all the time.
When he gets rid of DACA.
Coming soon, back. An entire just immigration-based podcast with Elise Foley. If you want that, just let us know. Arthur.
Bye.
Yeah, bye. Arthur says bye. We say bye. We say we'll be right back. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Zach Young. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by journalist and author James Polis, as well as Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Jonathan Cohn, Arthur Delaney, Elise Foley, and Lauren Weber. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Please check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, please subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send us an email at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening, and we miss you already.